The HSE's recommendation that the vaccination rollout should stick to an age-based strategy generates the lead story in today's Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail. Although the Mail takes the line that the strategy could result in further delays to the vaccine rollout, the Times reports that the advice given to government in advance of today's cabinet meeting includes the recommendation that any vaccine available should be used to keep up the pace of the rollout over the next 2 months. It's also expected that the same approach will apply to under 50s as to over 50s, which will mean that some people in their 40s could be offered Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca shots. People aged over 50 are being invited to register for vaccinations from today, and although the 40 to 49 age cohort is not expected to be reached for some weeks, some parallel vaccinations may take place where one group is being finished and the other has started. Ireland is set to benefit from an economic surge in the US, with unemployment here to drop below 10% by the end of the year. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Examiner. Eamon Quinn reports on a new survey from the Irish Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, which shows that Irish manufacturing has started to boom in recent weeks. AIB chief economist Oliver Mangan says that the April returns for purchasing managers working at the heart of Irish manufacturing reached record or near record readings as factories here join in a global rebound in industrial activity. Manufacturing employment also rose, and a spokesperson for the ESRI is quoted saying that it may also increase its targets for economic growth and tax revenues this year, and that unemployment may fall below 10%, the rate originally forecast by the end of the year. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that the government's auto-enrolment national pension scheme, which was to be set up by 2022, faces further delays as a result of the pandemic. A tweet from Ursula von der Leyen yesterday saying time to revive EU tourism industry features in the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mirror, which reports on the European Commission's assertion that travel restrictions should be eased in line with vaccination rates and case numbers. The Irish Sun leads today with the arrest of three men in Dublin yesterday in connection with the murder of a 17-year-old boy in Drogheda in January of last year. The death of Dennis Lynn, a leading County Down businessman who died in a quad bike accident on Sunday, is the lead story in the Irish News. The 63-year-old father of four was the founder of the Finnebrogue Artisan Food Company, which employs almost 1,000 people. The Belfast Telegraph leads today with the line that publicans in Northern Ireland who are trying to recoup the cost of COVID are warning customers to expect an increase in the price of the pint as bars reopen. And finally, the picture in the front of today's Times is of a couple holding an umbrella, struggling to protect themselves from yesterday's wet and windy conditions as they walked across Dublin's Samuel Beckett Bridge. Brollies on the bridge, bank holiday, a washout, is the headline there.
Well, as the HSE gives updated advice to the government on the COVID vaccination programme, a vaccine bonus will come into effect today for many people living in nursing homes. In homes with a high level of vaccination, residents will be able to receive four visits by two people every week. They will also be able to take part in organised outings by bus or car. Let's talk to Pat McLaughlin. He's CEO of the Alzheimer's Society. Pat, thanks for joining us this morning.
No problem, Rachel. Thanks.
Let's talk about this change coming into effect today. How does it differ from what's been in place for the past 6 weeks or so?
Well, there's been very little visitation, really, over the past year. That's what people living with dementia and their carers have found. So they have, in effect, not been able to get into nursing homes, or the visitation has been difficult. You know, it has been maybe outside the window trying to communicate. And, you know, as one carer said, not being able to see my husband now that he's in long-term care, he is non-verbal, and I'm outside the window trying to communicate. This is very hard. So you can imagine the difficulties that visitation and the lack of it has been causing for people, particularly where they have loss of cognitive ability, like people with dementia or Alzheimer's.
So what difference then do you hope that this change can make?
Well, we hope that the normal visitation will result in time, but this is certainly a major step and we welcome it because there's no doubt that the lack of stimulation and the lack of socialisation is causing difficulties, and carers are saying to us that the residents that they're visiting in nursing homes, when they do get there, that they're more isolated, they're more withdrawn, and that they're lacking that stimulation. They're finding the same in relation to the community services not being open as well. So it isn't just in the nursing home sector that they're finding this. It's the lack of face-to-face services such as daycare. Carers have had a very, very difficult 13, 14 months.
Mm. How important are these visits for people with dementia, that they're able to stay in regular touch with loved ones?
They're absolutely very important, and I think it's only when the visits stopped that people realised that families and visitors were actually providing stimulation to the person in the nursing home, and the nursing home staff could rely on the visitors to be able to let them know how the person was getting on, and they were able to tell them after the visit if there were anything that they were worried about. So when they stopped, you had a situation where there was no contact, and as one carer described it to me, the number of visits went from 28 in 1 week to zero. So you can imagine the impact that that had on the individual who was in the nursing home, because they may not have understood what COVID was, and they didn't understand why families and carers weren't visiting.
Mm. And I suppose often too with people with dementia, they might be talking about something. It might mean nothing to say somebody working in the home, but a family member can come in and say, ah, I know what he or who he or she is talking about.
You're absolutely right, Rachel. That type of reminiscence is very important and very helpful to the person because they're comfortable in that zone. They may have difficulty with their short-term memory, but they may be able to remember people and situations quite well from their past. And if there's somebody that they know who is visiting, obviously they can have a very good conversation. So they've been very, very helpful, those visits to people with the dementia in nursing homes. And I, as I said earlier, I think it's when they stopped we realised just the burden that people were living with.
Well, listen, let's hope then that today makes a big difference for a lot of people. Pat McLaughlin, CEO of the Alzheimer's Society, thanks indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
And we're turning to India, where ailing COVID patients continue to overwhelm the country's healthcare system. Another 3,400 people died from COVID yesterday, pushing the country death toll to more than 222,000, a figure widely believed to be an undercount. Hospitals are filled to capacity, supplies of oxygen have run short, and morgues and crematoriums have been overwhelmed. People are dying in ambulances, in car parks, outside hospitals. I'm joined now by Mandakini Gaylott, who's a journalist based in New Delhi. Mandakini, good morning to you. And is there any sign yet that this, what is a brutal second wave of infection and death that has hit India, is there any sign that it has reached its peak?
Thank you for inviting me. It's now been 15 days that here in the capital we've had shortages of oxygen, and oxygen is the third most abundant element in the universe, if I can point out. There's absolutely no sign that this is slowing down. It's a relentless. Experts estimate that we will only reach a peak sometime in mid-May, possibly at the end of June, at the end of May, by when they expect 1 million cases a day and countless thousands of deaths. At the moment, India has crossed over 400,000 cases. That's the most cases the world has ever seen through the course of this pandemic. And it's just grief and misery at a scale that I have never witnessed in my professional career as a journalist. You know, I've covered a lot of stories. I've covered terror attacks and refugee crises. And this is just, this is something else. It's the kind of story where you don't feel safe even at the end of the reporting day when you come back home. And it's just, it's so hard to describe. As I said, it's relentless.
I've heard you and other journalists talk about the heartbreak of watching what is happening at the hospitals and at the crematoriums. But why is it, Mandakini, that you are now, as you say, 15 days with an oxygen shortage in Delhi? India is not a poor country. Why has this not been addressed?
Absolutely. I'm glad you pointed that out. India certainly isn't a resource-poor country. And there just isn't any other way to say this except to say that the Indian government invited this carnage through its obfuscations, missteps, and complacency. As far as the oxygen goes, in the financial year, you know, the last financial year, India exported double the amount of oxygen that it normally does. Things at home seem to be okay. Case numbers had fallen to an all-time low. And instead of accumulating for a second wave that scientists said was coming, we just kept exporting it. The other thing is, sometime last year, the Prime Minister had set up an opaque fund called Prime Minister Cares, which collected donations from all over the world. And they announced that they were going to set up 163 oxygen generation plants through those funds. And at the beginning of April, only 33 had been set up and even fewer were operational. So the level of bungling here is really high. And as I keep saying, I imagine a lot of heads will roll when we have some time to, you know, catch our breath and really examine what went wrong, because there's already a very long list of what went wrong.
Other issues as well in a country that is the biggest producer of vaccines. You are vaccine poor in India for your own people. And in terms of the vaccines that are being rolled out, Pfizer has still not been approved.
Absolutely. Now, the largest vaccine rollout in the world began on May 1st. It was announced that everyone above the age of 18 would have access to a vaccine. Almost everyone I know in India, across the country, was glued to their computer screens or mobile phones, if they have one, to try and get an appointment. And almost no one got an appointment. Now, here in Delhi, some people have started to get appointments. But the biggest problem here is that our vaccine policy displays a level of inequity that perhaps even our country doesn't. Only people who live in large metropolitan cities, who have access to internet and who have some level of influence, are able to get appointments at the moment. So what went wrong? The fact is that so far the Indian government has only authorized two vaccines for the country and only two manufacturers to make them. A country with 1.3 billion people, no matter how large the company is, two companies are not going to be able to fulfill the needs of the entire company. So again, the need of the hour is to clear more vaccines and to authorize more manufacturers, and maybe even take some radical decisions like granting compulsory licenses, which is to say, allow manufacturers here to produce those vaccines, waive off the patents on the existing vaccines, and just sort of put them in overdrive and manufacture as many as you can. At least that's what the experts are saying, but that's certainly not what the government is doing right now.
Mandakini Gaylot in New Delhi, thank you for speaking to us on Morning Ireland.
An international anti-drug smuggling agency has said there's been a dramatic increase in the amount of cocaine it's intercepting. The Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre, which is based in Lisbon, says it has seized 20 tonnes of the drug so far this year. Michael O'Sullivan is the centre's director and he's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you give us an indication of the sort of seizures being made at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose they vary from, it's primarily cocaine. I suppose to put it in perspective, last year was the busiest year we had in what we call MAOC, the fusion centre that I'm in charge of. And we seized almost 2 billion euros worth of drugs, some 20 tonnes of cocaine, a massive amount. At this moment in time, we are almost up to that as it is. So for the first 3 months, 4 months of the year, we're probably going to exceed that by the end of the year. Putting it in perspective, cocaine is being shipped on an industrial level to Europe. The market is there in Europe, and we're very much dependent on the navies of Europe and the law enforcement agencies to try and intercept it. Sort of an upstream disruption. The thing is, if we can get the cocaine while on board a ship before it gets to land, once it gets to land, it's distributed, disseminated throughout Europe, and it's almost impossible to get. You rarely get you know, quarter ton seizures in on mainland Europe. So it is about seizing the drugs at sea. And to that end, we need the navies of Europe to work closely together with us. And we've been very successful. We work with a number of naval personnel at our centre. And in particular, we now see that there's quite a lot of drugs have been intercepted in the last 18 months, with the result that organised crime groups are now trying to ship the drugs towards West Africa, to the Gulf of Guinea, and then move it up north and try to come into southern Spain and maybe even into northern Spain. Last year, we intercepted for the first time a semi-submersible submarine. It took 23 days to cross the Atlantic. It had a crew of three, and it was carrying, I think it was, €2 million worth of cocaine. What I'm trying to say is the organized crime groups are trying every route possible and every angle possible to get the drugs into Europe. We're very much seen as the front line against drugs in Europe. We're working very closely with the Irish Navy. As you can appreciate, they cover some 12% of all EU waters. So when any vessels come towards Northern Europe, we're dependent on them to try and track them or indeed intercept them. So we have a situation now where rather than you would have the odd yacht coming in with a ton, we now have large ships carrying multi-tons, 4 or 5 tons, and they're being met by what we would call a daughter vessel, a go-fast or a fishing vessel, which would offload the drugs and bring it to the country. There's been a recent, a difficult, challenging development insofar as we intercepted two vessels in the last couple of months, and before the boarding parties got to the vessels, the people on the vessels jumped overboard and exploded the vessel. So it's quite a challenging, exercise or interception for the various navies who have to do that. So it's really upping the game all the time. It's very much a cat and mouse.
Can I ask you about the level of demand? Because I would have thought that given that there has been in many, many places less socialising over the past year, that perhaps the demand for cocaine would have gone down.
No, the demand for cocaine, certainly since last March, organised crime groups decided let's not waste a good crisis, and they increased the flow of cocaine in the hope that the navies and the law enforcement agencies at Europe would be distracted by the coronavirus. The demand in Europe is at an all-time level. The demand for cocaine alone is almost €13 billion. So the disposable income is there in Europe. The market is there. In fact, there are figures beginning to show there's more coke coming from South America to Europe than there is to North America. And the reason for that is people have the money. During the recession, we saw figures drop. We saw organized crime groups unable to get the cash. We saw the punters unable to get the cash. People just hadn't got the money. People have the money. So whether they're socializing or going to pubs or not, they are using cocaine, and the South Americans have lots of it, and they're bringing it and making huge profits to Europe. It shows no sign of decreasing. If anything, it's I won't say doubling, but it's going to be very close to doubling.
All right. Listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line this morning. Michael O'Sullivan there, the director of the Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre based in Lisbon.
And after more than 4 months of a reduced daily train schedule, a full weekday service resumes today, I heard, ahead of further increases in capacity from next week. With the details, Barry Kenny, you're in with Aaron's Corporate Communications Manager. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Mary.
So are you returning now to pre-COVID, to a pre-COVID timetable for weekdays and weekends?
Yes, it's a full timetable across the network. Obviously, we were back to that, as was last summer as well. But as you say, this year, we've had a revised and reduced schedule since the 11th of January. We've added some services and additional capacity as the schools have come back. But as each measure, I suppose, in the reopening of society and the economy goes through, we obviously respond. So that's a full schedule operating from today. As you say, the capacity on board remains at 25%. So that's the capacity that's available for use. That will increase to 50% under the government measures from next Monday. But for today, it's a full timetable at 25% of onboard capacity.
And what about other changes that were introduced since lockdowns began? I'm thinking about the booking of tickets, which I think has to be done now online. And you're also encouraging contactless payments where possible, aren't you?
Yes, I suppose for people who haven't travelled with us in some time, and in some cases that'll be well over a year at this stage, we're still operating in a situation where it is essential travel. Face coverings are mandatory on board and in our stations unless a customer is medically exempt. For intercity travel, as you say, so the longer distance travel, that does have to be booked in advance. Online at irishrail.ie. You'll see on board, obviously, there are seat coverings in the carriage to indicate the seats that can be used. Again, for people travelling longer distances, catering has been suspended on board right through this, and obviously alcohol isn't permitted on any rail services. There's hand sanitizers, the type of things people are seeing in businesses around the country. There's hand sanitizers at all our stations and enhanced cleaning in place, and again, distancing markings in waiting areas and stations as well.
And do you keep your eye on the numbers through the computer bookings, or are there strict countings as people go on board?
It is through the computer bookings, and obviously are in terms of the more open systems, the Dart and Commuter, our staff around the network will be monitoring that as well. And we don't expect today to see a significant jump. It has been rising steadily, but then obviously you move to next week when we are in a position to increase from 25% to 50% of onboard capacity in line with the government guidelines as restrictions are eased further. So we'll continue to monitor that to ensure that we are in a position to provide the capacity that is needed with those limitations right through as long as this pandemic continues.
Yeah, so you've seen a small but gradual increase on the intercity services. What has been happening on Dart services?
It has certainly a peak, I suppose, particularly since the schools have come back. We've been under a bit of pressure there within the 25% capacity. And I would stress to people that capacity for Dart and Commuter, that relates to sitting and standing capacity. So standing is going to be in place, but obviously nowhere near the levels that people will have seen before COVID, back when we had very, very high demand and pressure on capacity. But we have been adding services, additional darts out of Greystones, additional capacity for end of school days as well out of Balbriggan and other places in recent weeks. But again, from today, that full schedule is back. One point is that there will be some minor changes on some services to departure times from the old full timetable. So people should just check their times before travel again on the website irishrail.ie.
All right, Barry, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Barry Kenny there from Éireann Ráda Éireann.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And let's get the sport now from Darren Frehel. Morning to you, Darren.
Good morning, Rachel. Had a late one last night. Stayed up to watch the snooker, and I'm going to be honest with you, I am so glad I did. We got an absolutely classic final at the Crucible. Victory in the end went to Mark Selby, beating Sean Murphy 18-15, winning that World Snooker title for a fourth time. But an absolutely classic game, and a really good 2 weeks' work, I think, for Mark Selby. Certainly deserved it, and he picked up a cheque for £500,000, and he also moves up to number two in the world rankings. But the great match, though, I think, was down in no small part to the performance of Sean Murphy last night. Really tough year for him. Based in Ireland, his wife and kids live in Dublin, and he struggled to get in and out of the country as he would have liked during the season. So it's been a really testing time for him, but also really gracious in defeat last night. Let's hear from him.
Life has been, you know, very, very difficult for everybody, hasn't it, in the last 12 months? Coronavirus has affected us, you know, in a way that none of us could have predicted. And, of course, life on tour has been, you know, good, but difficult in a lot of ways. For people who don't live on this island, life has been quite difficult, and a lot's been made of that. But, you know, I want to say a very deep personal thank you to every single one of you that have bought a ticket. Sport's nothing without the fans. You know, we've been so thrilled to have everyone back this last fortnight.
Yeah, great to see the fans back there as well. Sean, a former winner, of course, but that was his third final defeat. Must be really tough on him. Shamrock Rovers top of the SSE Electricity League Premier Division pile. They beat Waterford 3-0, and that makes it 31 league games unbeaten. It's a new League of Ireland record, top of the table on 23 points. And their manager, Stephen Bradley, though, not all too happy, wasn't happy with some of the tackling last night. Two of his key players, Aaron Green and Neil Ferrucci, went off injured. He's been speaking to John Kenny.
It was a really poor tackle on Aaron. And,
you're a little annoyed?
Yeah,
about
really
that.
Annoyed, because I think if the ref takes control of that one, well, then we don't get the one up there in the last minute as well. Like, they're two reckless tackles. There's tackles in games and things happen and people commit fouls, but not the way that was, from behind and right down the back of his Achilles, you know. So it's a problem, and we'll have to see ourselves down over the next few days.
Sure, just to finish that question then about Neil Ferrucci.
Neil's. Like you said, we have to be really patient since the 21s. We got him back on, he was doing okay, and then he felt the same spot again. So, again, we'll have to assess it in the morning. Hopefully it was just a little nerve twitch. Hopefully it's not major, but we don't know till tomorrow.
Just 2 points ahead of St. Pat's, who drew 1-1 with third place Sligo Rovers, and they had the thank for a late equaliser deep in injury time in that one to get that share of the spoils. We'll hear from their camp later. Dundalk came from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with Longford Town. Finn Harps got the better of Derry 2-1. Bow slipped up again, 1-1 draw away to Drogheda. In the Premier League, West Ham beat Burnley 2-1. The Hammers fifth now, just 3 points behind fourth place Chelsea. Wolves and West Brom drew 1-1. There's a place in the Champions League final up for grabs tonight. Manchester City host PSG in the semi-final second leg. 2-1 lead in that one. 8 o'clock start at on RT2 this evening. And finally, the GA awaiting clarification from government on whether non-playing members of the panel will be allowed to attend games in the Allianz League when it resumes this weekend. Damien Lawler has more.
With the inter-county season just days away from starting, the GAA are still awaiting clarification from the government on whether non-playing panel members will be allowed to attend games. The Allianz Hurling League begins this Saturday, with the football equivalent commencing a week later. Both competitions take place behind closed doors. When inter-county games restarted last winter, just 26 squad members per county were allowed to attend. This figure drew much criticism from managers who wanted permission for full panels to attend games. The number was later extended by Minister of State for Sport Jack Chambers when he confirmed that non-playing panel members would be allowed to attend remaining games in the 2020 Championships. But that announcement coincided with Ireland moving to Level 3 restrictions. With the country operating under Level 5 restrictions for all of this year, the most recent published public health advice indicates that only necessary personnel can attend games. The GAA is looking for clarity on whether that has changed, and they expect that confirmation will be imminent.
Back with more sport in an hour.
Well, after a slow start, there's been a significant increase in the number of COVID vaccines being administered across Europe. Many countries have begun the process of lifting restrictions, but in some places, infection rates remain a problem. Now, in a moment, we're going to take a look at developments in a couple of EU countries, but we're going to start with London-based journalist Vincent McAvinney. As you know, the vaccination programme in the UK has been well ahead of most EU countries. Vincent, the reopening seems to be moving pretty swiftly now. Where are things at?
Yeah, that's right. The Prime Minister's timetable, which many thought was quite ambitious back in January, seems to be rolling along. So the next date that everyone's got on their calendar is May the 17th, when things like indoor dining and hospitality will open, cinemas and theatres will be able to open. And then in June, if everything has gone well, all restrictions are expected to be lifted, and things like international travel and social distancing international travel will start again. We're waiting for this green list of countries, and social distancing, we understand, will be dropped as well.
Are there any clouds on the horizon?
Well, it is all to do with keeping up the rate of the vaccinations. We've now crossed 50 million vaccinations. Yesterday, there were only 1,600 new cases and only one death from COVID in a 24-hour period. So that is quite a remarkable figure compared to where we were a few months ago. We're at the point now where basically everyone who is 42 and above is eligible for a COVID vaccine. We're waiting for those who are 30 and above to be told they can. But we do know that some of the supply has tapered off because it needs to be used in India, and that's where most of the manufacturing was being done as well. So there is a question mark as to whether or not that supply will continue, but there is definitely a demand for it. We've seen vaccine hesitancy across all groups falling away, but it's just about the supply of vaccines now.
There are elections, a lot of elections, due to take place later this week for the Scottish and Welsh parliaments, for the London Assembly, and also some English local elections. Logistically, how's all of that going to work?
Well, these elections, you're allowed to do a postal ballot. You can also do a proxy ballot as well if you feel that you are vulnerable. And you can turn up. We're being told that there will be cleaning regimes in place, that there will be social distancing, which is marshalled. And so these elections were actually delayed from last year. It was felt that it was now safe enough for them to go ahead. So we'll see. And there's expected to be quite a high turnout because in Scotland, of course, the SNP have turned it into an issue about triggering perhaps a second independence referendum. And in Wales, I was there last week and they're expecting their highest turnout ever because people there have seen for the first time in the 21 years since the parliament there was started that it can actually flex some real power, that they can do different things to England. And so there are high turnouts expected.
Vincent, many thanks for that. We're going to go now to the Netherlands and Stephanie Vandenberg, who's a Reuters correspondent there. Stephanie, I was looking at a picture this morning of people sitting outside a cafe in the Netherlands, but at the same time, I was reading about the next phase of reopening being postponed. So what's happening at the moment?
Well, what's happening is that they had eased restrictions from the 1st of May, which is why you could see the people sitting outdoors on the terrace. But they had done so in the expectations that numbers would lower, but that lower number never actually came through. So hospitals are still kind of at full capacity. We still have a lot of hospitalizations, and the government basically said because the lowering of hospitalization rates that we were expecting didn't come through, we can now not move forward with more easing as planned.
That must be very disappointing for people.
It has, but what also is happening is that it's one of the coldest Aprils in 35 years in the Netherlands. So all this people being excited about sitting outside on terraces, it's not really materializing because it's rainy and very cold over here right now. So there's not a lot of people willing to go out. And that also means that people are meeting more indoors, which is, you know, for contamination and infection rates is worse. So I think at the moment, everybody's kind of holding their breath to see what's going to happen.
How has the vaccination rollout been going in the Netherlands?
Well, as you might know, the Netherlands was one of the last countries in the EU to start vaccinations, and they've been kind of slow to catch up because of the trouble with AstraZeneca deliveries and then the trouble with the side effects of AstraZeneca. The Dutch are not giving AstraZenecas to the under 60s. And so while they are picking up the pace somewhat, it's only at just over 5 million. And when I hear the figures from the UK before with over 50 million vaccinated, I kind of turn green with envy. It's not going anywhere near so fast in the Netherlands.
Stephanie, many thanks for joining us. Stephanie Vandenberg there of Reuters in the Netherlands. And we're going to go now to Denmark, and we can talk to journalist Tom Carstensen, who's in Copenhagen. Thanks for joining us, Tom. Talk to us about the vaccination program in Denmark, if you would, because there has been a couple of big announcements.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday it was announced that the Johnson & Johnson is not going to be rolled out as part of the government plan, as well as the AstraZeneca has been pulled off the plan as well. But the health body also said that they are now fine with people having those two type of vaccinations voluntarily. So people can, they're still trying to set up how it's going to work, but people can actually get those two if they want to, which is going to take off a bit of the delay that it would otherwise give to the Danish vaccination. I think we have about 11.5% or something like that are now fully vaccinated, and about 23% have had their first jab. So of course, when these these products get pulled off, it's obviously delaying the whole program. But now you can do it voluntarily. That's the new plan here.
Can you talk to us then about the opening up process? Because I gather you were at a soccer match last night.
I was at a soccer match and at a pub, which is something I haven't done in a long, long time, which was
wow.
A nice change. Yeah, I know. It was a nice change of scenery. The reopening has begun. And for instance, the soccer match, they can open at a certain capacity. I think it's about 30%. So there was 11,000 people in a ground that normally hosts 36,000. And last night there was, very early this morning actually, a large deal struck in Parliament where the reopening has been pushed forward, which means from Thursday, all school children from in the primary and secondary school are back at full capacity, that's been pushed up. And from this Thursday as well, there's going to be more opening in regards to cafes, restaurants. You can go to the gym on Thursday, and up until now you could do some of these things, but you had to have something called a Corona passport, which meant you had to have a test that showed that you didn't have COVID that was less than 72 hours old. And that's going to go away, some of it at least, on Thursday. So they are pushing the reopening, and we do have very, very low hospitalization rates. We have 700 or something catching COVID or being tested positive every day, but that is people we're testing far more than 100,000 a day, so it's a very low number. So we've nowhere near full capacity in the hospitals, so it seems that we're going to be reopening a lot more, but it's only going to be controlled. There's going to be no festivals and stuff like that in the summer. That's been pointed out today as well, but there's light at the end of the tunnel here, it seems.
Well, that's great to hear. Tom, thank you very much. Tom Carstensen there, journalist in Copenhagen.
AIB confirmed plans last week to move to a hybrid working model, which, like many other companies, will allow its staff to work from home for up to 3 days a week. The bank had already confirmed plans to vacate three of its six Dublin office buildings. Bank of Ireland also recently said it was leaving its leased Messable Road headquarters as it further reduces its office floor space. Marie Hunt, executive director and head of research with property consultancy CBRE, is on the line. And the banks have been reducing their office footprint for quite a while now, Marie, which has perhaps been accelerated by COVID. But is this a sign of things to come across the wider office sector?
Good morning. Absolutely. I think we're going to see this move to a hybrid working model. I think working from home has accelerated a trend that was happening anyway. So for many organisations, they're going to have people working from home, not full-time, but certainly more than they would have previously. So that is leading some companies to put some office space back into the market, including the two banks you've mentioned. But on the other side of the coin, you have some of the tech and professional services companies looking for additional space. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer. I think it will be very, very different for every organization and indeed for every industry.
So is this manifesting itself in the vacancy rate, for example? Are we seeing the vacancy rate going up, or is it too early to tell at this stage?
Yes, I think the vacancy rate has gone up over the last 12 months, but it's predominantly because of this increase in grey space, which is companies offloading excess accommodation, more so than new stock, because by virtue of the sites being shut down or the non-essential sites being shut down, development has completely stalled. So in actual fact, if you look at what was meant to be delivered in terms of new office buildings in 2020, only about 56% of it actually got built, and the rest of that has now fallen into 2021, and by virtue of the sites being still shut down, some of that stock will now fall into 2022. So I suppose in tandem with a slowdown in activity, we've also had a slowdown in development, so one has matched the other. So the vacancy rate has gone up, and it probably has a little bit further to go. It's currently at 9.6%. It's probably going to go over 10%, but it's not going to be anywhere near as dramatic as the sort of increase in vacancy we would have saw post-global financial crisis.
And are prices dropping in that environment?
The level of headline rent has certainly softened, but not dramatically so. But I think what has definitely changed is that it's very much a tenant's market at the moment in terms of the length of lease the break options and the incentives that you will get in terms of signing a lease. And that will probably change very dramatically once the market reverts back. So there is a window of opportunity for anybody in the market today looking to sign a lease, because landlords will give them a better deal than what might be available in 6 or 12 months' time.
As you say, the construction may have been stalled for the last few months, but it does appear there's quite a bit of office construction activity underway, particularly around Dublin city centre. Despite the fact that there is demand from technology companies, for example, is there a danger, though, that some of it might be left idle, or could you indeed see plans being altered to develop perhaps housing accommodation instead?
Well, I think on the surface, Brian, what you would see is lots of cranes and lots of development, but what you don't necessarily see is that quite a lot of that stock is already pre-let. So, in fact, some of the announcements that were made a year or 2 years ago, that they have committed to space that's under construction now. So I wouldn't be overly concerned by the volume of construction that's underway, because quite a lot of that stock is not speculative stock. And I suppose that's a key difference to last time as well. In terms of conversion to residential, I don't think that's really an option from a planning perspective here. And certainly by the time you would do that, you're going to be into a completely different cycle as well. So I don't necessarily see that being the case.
Murray Hunt of CBRE, thank you very much.
Thank you, Elaine. It's 7 minutes past eight, and here with what it says in this morning's papers is Fiona Kelly.
The HSE's advice that older people should continue to be vaccinated first, and good news as a surge is reported in manufacturing, are some of the stories carried on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail both lead with that advice from the HSE that the vaccination rollout should stick to an age-based strategy. Although the Mail takes the line that the strategy could result in further delays, the Times reports that the advice given to government in advance of today's cabinet meeting includes the recommendation that any vaccine available should be used to keep up the pace of the rollout over the next 2 months. For its lead story, the Irish Examiner reports on a new survey from the Irish Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, which shows that Irish manufacturing has started to boom in recent weeks. AIB chief economist Oliver Mangan says that record or near record readings were reached last month as factories here join in a global rebound in industrial activity. Manufacturing employment also rose, and a spokesperson for the ESRI is quoted saying that it may also increase its targets for economic growth and tax revenues this year, and that unemployment may fall below 10%, the rate originally forecast by the end of the year. The lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror reports on the European Commission's assertion yesterday that travel restrictions should be eased in line with vaccination rates and case numbers. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that the government's auto-enrolment national pension scheme faces further delays as a result of the pandemic. The Irish Sun leads today with the arrest of three men in Dublin yesterday in connection with the murder of a 17-year-old boy in Drogheda in January of last year. Brian Meehan, who has served 21 years of the life sentence he received for the murder of journalist Veronica Guerin, is due to be moved to Shelton Abbey Open Prison in County Wicklow in the coming days. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Daily Star. The death of Dennis Lynn, a leading County Down businessman who died in a quad bike accident on Sunday, is the lead story in the Irish News. The 63-year-old father of four was the founder of the Finnebrogue Artisan Food Company, which employs almost 1,000 people. The Belfast Telegraph leads today with the line that publicans in Northern Ireland are warning customers to expect an increase in the price of the pint as bars there reopen. Elsewhere this morning, The Times and Examiner both give front page coverage to a warning issued by the College of Psychiatrists of Ireland that cannabis is the gravest threat to the mental health of young people in Ireland. The group, which is calling on the government to conduct an urgent review of cannabis use, says that it fears that psychiatric services could be overrun by a surge in young people needing treatment as a result of cannabis use over the coming years. The number of money laundering crimes recorded in the state more than doubled last year. That's on the front of the Times. And the Examiner reports on its front page this morning that Education Minister Norma Foley is prepared to make legislative changes if needed to ensure that students get an inclusive sex education programme. And finally, there's a piece in today's Independent about the Wildlands Adventure Centre in Moycullen, County Galway, which is reopened this week and is already fully booked up with school groups until the end of June. After years of planning and research, siblings Faye and David Bohan had just opened the centre on the family farm last August before they were forced to close up 2 months later. They focused on providing a takeaway service from their Olive Tree restaurant during the lockdown, but now they're back in the business of having fun as they reopen their centre, which includes a 3D playtown for small children and a Crystal Maze style challenge room based on Irish mythology.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Good morning once again to Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Mary. Let's start with the snooker. And what a match last night between Mark Selby and Sean Murphy. Mark Selby winning that one 18 frames to 15. He's the world champion for the fourth time. And he had done much of the heavy lifting prior to that final session, building up a 14-11 lead. But then Murphy came storming back last night. And he made a real match of it. But Selby held his nerve, won it by 3 frames in the end. A deserved win. And now he's among the greats with a fourth world title.
Absolutely incredible, you know. Every time you get to a world final, you always try that. You try your hardest because it's such a tough tournament to get there. You never know whether it's going to be your last or not. So, as I said before, to win it once against O'Sullivan for the first time was a dream come true, but to win it four times is just only something I can dream of.
Some great news on the golf front. Seamus Power, who is originally from Waterford, based in the US now, has qualified for the Wells Fargo Championship. He's done really well. 62 last night, bogey-free round, 8 under par, and he's won that qualifier at the Gaston Country Club in North Carolina. So well done to him. Shamrock Rovers are now top of the pile in the SSE or Trissy League Premier Division. A 3-0 win against Waterford. Just 2 points ahead of St. Pat's, who drew 1-1 with third place Sligo Rovers. Sligo looked to be on course for the win, only for Pat's to equalise deep in injury time. Adrian Eames has been speaking to both management teams. In a moment, Liam Buckley, but first, Alan Matthews.
Their first round of games, and if someone had said, look, this is where you'll be at the end of it at the start, we'd have taken their hand off. But I mean, that's the first time that we've gone down in this round of games. And again, the players responded brilliantly to it. Penalty probably was. Paddy seemed to barge the player, and it was a penalty. So we had to show good character to come back. And at the end of the first series of games, as I say, we're in a really good position. And we could have lost the game today. We mightn't have scored that equaliser. We still would have been in a very good position. But the fact that we've bounced down and got the goal gives us a great lift going home.
Liam, it's a point against one of the leading sides in the division, but does it feel almost like a defeat, the manner in which you conceded the late goal?
It does, yeah. We'll be bitterly disappointed in the dressing room that we didn't see it out, bearing in mind we've got a throw-in at the top end of the park. It's given to them. They've threw it in down the park corner and they've scored in the last little 10 seconds of the game here. I thought we'd done enough to win it. But look, it is what it is. We just push on. It's only a quarter of the season gone.
Dundalk came from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with Longford. Finn Harps got the better of Derry 2-1. Bowes slipped up again. They drew 1-1 with Drogheda. In the Premier League, West Ham up to fifth. They beat Burnley 2-1. Wolves and West Brom drew 1-1. There's a place in the Champions League final up for grabs tonight. Manchester City host PSG in the semi-final, second leg. City take a 2-1 lead into that game. 8 o'clock kickoff. It's live on RT2, and our commentator George Hamilton, as always, joins me ahead of these big games. George, let's look at this one. City and PSG, fascinating game in prospect. And from a PSG perspective, will their key man Kylian Mbappe be fit tonight?
They don't know. That's the answer. He trained on his own yesterday. He had a right calf injury that kept him out of the team at the weekend. And they're waiting to see what the reaction will be as to whether or not he can play. But L'Équipe, the French sports newspaper, has him in their predicted lineup. So the feeling is that he will start, even if he's not quite 100% fit. You know, he burst on the scene in Manchester just 4 years ago when he made his Champions League debut at Manchester City playing for Monaco. City won that one 5-3. Mbappe had scored just before halftime. Then he scored the opening goal in the return leg in Monaco, which helped put Monaco through on away goals. And the following morning, he was called up for the first time for France. 6 months after that at the Etihad, he signed for PSG for €180 million. So I think he's quite important.
Yeah. How's it going to go tonight?
Well, it's a remarkable story, isn't it? Manchester City within an ace of winning the Premier League and within an ace of reaching their very first Champions League final. But you know, Paris Saint-Germain, though, they've lost 8 times at home in the Parc des Princes. They've had big wins away this season in Barcelona, in Manchester United, of course, and at Bayern Munich as well. They put 2 big wins in the French League as well, away from home at Lyon and Marseille. And you know, their last 2 visits to England have been to Manchester. They won 2-0 in the round of 16, and they won 3-1 this year at Manchester United, of course. So Manchester City stand in their way. You'd have to fancy City the way the season has gone for Manchester City and the way that they don't concede goals. And Paris Saint-Germain need 2 to get through at least. And City have the best defence of any of the 4 teams left in the Champions League. They've only conceded 4 in their 11 games.
Final word and a quick one on Chelsea and Madrid tomorrow night. You worked on the first leg. How do you see that one going? It's 1-1.
Yeah, well, the away goal and Chelsea at home, and Chelsea don't tend to concede goals, and Tuchel has this remarkable record of not letting goals in, has sorted out the defence. Real Madrid have to score to have a chance. Big news there is they will have Ramos back. He's recovered from his injury. He will return to captain the side, but against that, they've lost Varane with a thigh injury, so he'll be out. So I just think with Ramos back in the team, it's a little more treacherous for Chelsea than it would otherwise have been.
Looking forward to both games. Thanks, George, as always. Finally, Katrina Parrock has confirmed she's returned to the Wexford Camogie panel ahead of the new season. 4-time All-Ireland winner, stepped away in 2017 to turn her attention to a successful soccer career. Been dropping hints on social media recently, but confirmed the news. She's on the way back yesterday. That's your sport for now.
Last month, Ireland's Network Against Racism revealed that the highest number of racist incidents were recorded to it in 2019. For the past 8 years, iReport has been compiling data for the organisation from information submitted by people who have been subjected to racism. In the first of 3 reports, our social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally explores the question of racism in Ireland and what needs to be done to tackle the problem.
Today's conference was told how the ugly monster of racism has taken to our streets.
What's needed here is leadership. Leadership to ensure that attitudes change and that people are welcome, not just tolerated.
This report was broadcast by RTE in the year 2000, but it's a report that is just as relevant today. In the last 21 years, Irish society has changed as a result of immigration, and yet little has been done to tackle the problem of racism. Professor of Migration and Social Policy at UCD, Brian Fanning.
Certainly, I think Irish society is pretty tolerant of immigration. That basically, if you look at the right-wing parties that are trying to become established, they basically attract a very small group of people. That most people, I think, would like to see Ireland as an open and tolerant society. However well-meaning that is, though, our institutions don't look like the wider diversity of our society, such as, say, the civil service, the teachers in our schools, perhaps even the media. Academia could be more representative, I think, of wider society also. So I think there is a sort of an onus in us then to see that those institutions begin to reflect the diversity of our society, just as they also need to reflect diversity around gender and other issues also. I mean, if our institutions don't look like who we are, they're not going to do a great job on our behalf, I think.
That diversity is not evident where the biggest decisions are made, the Oireachtas. Politicians like Senator Eileen Flynn, who's a member of the traveller community, understands the struggle in getting beyond the gates of Leinster House.
Those gates have been shut for so, so long, these gates behind me, and they're opened a little bit now at present, and I'm hoping that they will open up even wider for people from ethnic minority groups and for people who genuinely have an interest in politics, because like black people and traveller people are not just black people and not just travellers, if you know what I mean. We are also people that have an interest in the world, that wants to be doctors, nurses, wants to be solicitors and want to be politicians. And I was very lucky to get the opportunity that I got. Unfortunately, I missed out by a very narrow margin. And I'm still grateful, and I will always be grateful to the Aunt Taoiseach Micheál Martin for nominating me as one of his 11. But also I think it's very important that we acknowledge the work that I've done to get to where I am today, and the work that women in general from ethnic minority groups, and how it's tough for all women, but we never really look at how tough it is for women from ethnic minority groups.
Representation is also important at a local level. Fianna Fáil's Arimu Adetami is a member of Longford County Council.
We are moving into a new modern Ireland where we'll have to, you know, take stock of who is in the country, who are the people, who are we representing, what type of Ireland do we want to see tomorrow, what type of Ireland do we want to hand over to the next generation. There's a lot of mixed race children in Ireland, a lot of children from migrant background, so there's going to be a lot of interrelations. And you know, if we want to see a better Ireland, a more ethical society, we need to start, you know, moving on swiftly from having the conversations to making sustainable changes that will see us into a better Ireland.
Beyond their day jobs, these women face relentless levels of racism through social media.
I try to raise above it, even though it's very hurtful. It is extremely hurtful, and I report it to ENR, ireport.ie, and I do report the discrimination, and I block people, you know, and I will be honest, I do block people, and I won't say that sometimes I write back to people, you know, when they are a little bit, when they are racist to me, because I think I have every right to respond to them as Eileen Flynn, and not even as a public representative, because they're attacking me for being Eileen, you know.
It's called social media. If you're being antisocial, you shouldn't be on social media. So there definitely have to be punitive measures for people that are anything but social. Thankfully, I don't get too much, and fingers crossed, I won't. But I try to maintain a positive profile online, because it's so important. If any, there's any negative comments on my page or on my social media, I just hide them, because I don't want to see them. I don't want my followers to see them, and I don't want anybody to engage with that.
In the year 2000, the internet was in its infancy and people didn't have their own mobile devices, so this form of racism wasn't an issue. While the government's publication of hate crime legislation has been welcomed, Ireland's Human Rights and Equality Commissioner Sinead Gibney says it's not enough.
There is legislation progressing at the moment to deal with online hate speech, but I do think that Ireland also needs to consider its role as a country which houses platforms here in Ireland. So many of the tech companies are based here in Ireland, and what their role is. And I don't think we are dealing with that yet as a society, and certainly I don't think government are dealing with it. I mean, if internet platforms are profiting through the polarisation of views or the proliferation of hate speech online, we have to look at that.
Human Rights and Equality Commissioner Sinead Gibney ending that report from Alva Keneally. We'll have more tomorrow.
Now, like it or not, many people view cannabis as a relatively harmless drug. But today, the Irish College of Psychiatrists is launching a new public health campaign to dispel what it says is a myth. The college says there's been an alarming rise in people being admitted to emergency departments and psychiatric wards due to significantly more potent cannabis products, more than cocaine and heroin combined. And it says the situation is getting worse. Fíochra O'Kiona reports.
I started off about 13 or 14. I just wanted to try it. Then it turned into every day, and I wasn't working. I couldn't afford it. So I started selling drugs to pay for it.
Dean is 17 and from Kilkenny. Like many young people, he experimented with cannabis, but it soon became an addiction.
If it didn't include weed, I had no real purpose in it. I missed two Christmases and I missed two of my birthdays. I just couldn't remember. And as I went on, I realised it was a problem, and I took it up in my own hands to go to rehab, Ashland Centre. I was like, you know, enough is enough.
Dean's story is one doctors are increasingly hearing. So much so that today the Irish College of Psychiatrists is launching a new cannabis awareness campaign.
We have been concerned for some time that the public discourse about cannabis is coming from one side. We wanted to put out there what we're seeing in our clinics, because it's not harmless.
Dr. Jerry McCarney is a child and adolescent psychiatrist with the HSE's Dublin Addiction Service. He says the cannabis now available is far more potent than in the past due to higher THC levels. And Dr. McCarney says increased potency brings increased risks.
Anything over 10% THC, just high potency cannabis, we frequently have strains available that are over 10%. We are seeing significant increases in anxiety, self-harming behavior, and suicidal ideation. It is worrying that as the THC content increases, we are seeing more of this.
The Irish College of Psychiatrists say the figures support the concerns, with 309 people admitted to psychiatric hospitals for cannabis-related issues in 2019. It's a national record and the 300% rise since 2007. Here's Dr. McCarney again.
If you look back at the hospital admission data, you can see about a 300% increase into the hospitals, greater than admission for heroin use or for cocaine use. A young person from time to time would have begun at the age of 7, 8, 9. Cannabis that people might remember from 20, 30 years ago is not the animal that's out there now.
It's a view shared by Dr. Anne O'Doherty, a liaison psychiatrist at the Mater Hospital's emergency department. Dr. O'Doherty says serious physical risks also come with increased cannabis potency. Almost 900 people attended hospital for physical issues related to cannabis use in 2019, four times more than in 2005.
We frequently see people with palpitations or heart arrhythmia secondary to cannabis. We also see people with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which is a condition where people have unrelenting nausea and vomiting due to cannabis. In addition to that, of course, in the emergency department, we tend to see people who have their first episodes of drug-induced psychosis, which is a truly horrible condition, and you wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy.
But not everyone agrees with the level of concern being raised.
There's an element of hysteria in regards to cannabis.
Gene O'Kenny is Solidarity People Before Profit TD for Dublin Midwest. He accepts increased cannabis potency means increased problems for users. But ultimately, he believes the solution is decriminalisation and as a result, regulation.
We all understand cannabis potency is higher than it was. But I think it's important to educate people in relation to, I suppose, drug use. This year, I'll introduce a bill called the Cannabis Regulation Control Bill. Prohibition on cannabis has been a failure, and legalisation would be have regulation.
Frank Feehan is a Fine Gael TD for Sligo Leitrim and Minister of State for Public Health, Wellbeing and the National Drug Strategy. He has a different view.
Well, the government have already established a working group in 2017, and the working group examined the options of decriminalising drugs and didn't deem that it would be appropriate. There are no plans to decriminalise drugs, including cannabis. We urge anybody with concerns to use visitdrugs.ie. It really contains practical advice.
Earlier, we heard from Dean. He's now drug-free for 1 year, and his advice to those thinking of using cannabis is simple.
I struggle still, but you're going to struggle. It's just how you deal with it. I know this from experience. Don't go out and just smoke weed because you're curious. It's not anything that's made out to be.
Dean from Kilkenny, ending that report by Fiacra O'Kiona at